This is the second lecture on the topic of Social Security. We'll start out by asking, why is Social Security an annuity? So let's review. An annuity calculation determines how much you can spend each year if you are going to live N years and have X dollars. So let's say you knew you were going to live 10 years and you had $300,000. Now you might think, well, I'll just divide the $300,000 by 10 and spend $30,000 a year. But what that doesn't take into account is the fact that your money can earn interest. The money that you don't spend earns interest. So you can actually spend a little bit more than $30,000 a year if you have $300,000 and 10 years to live. So the annuity calculation takes into account the fact that you can earn interest and will figure out exactly what you could calculate, what you could spend each year. Now the next concept is an insured annuity. And the idea of an insured annuity is that most people don't know exactly how long they have to live when they retire. So when you retire and you have $300,000, you can say, well, I think I'll live about 10 years, but I might live 5 years, I might live 20 years. So how much do I spend in that case? And the idea of an insured annuity is you go to a life insurance company and they have an idea of what the probability is that you will live 5 years, 10, 20 years. And based on that, they give you an annuity that they will pay regardless of how long you live. So if you die in just 5 years, they end up paying out less than they expected. If you live exactly the 10 years that you expected, they pay out exactly what they expected. If you live surprisingly long, let's say 15 or 20 years, then the insurance company may take a loss. They may end up paying out more than what they priced the annuity at. So the insurance company takes all the risk that you will live excessively long, and that's what you're buying insurance against the possibility that you would outlive your assets. Nobody wants to do that. You don't want to wind up 12 years from now being completely out of money because you never believed you would live this long. So that's the concept of an insured annuity. And you'll see how that relates to Social Security. Well, Social Security, in fact, pays out an insured annuity. That is, when you hit 65, Social Security doesn't all of a sudden pay you a lump sum. They don't say, okay, you've retired, you're now on Social Security, here's the amount of Social Security you've accumulated, boom, here it is. They don't do that. They pay it out as an annuity, as an insured annuity. And you could argue that this certainly makes sense, that people need insurance against living too long, so it makes sense that Social Security would be structured as an insured annuity rather than as a lump sum. One argument that some economists make is that individuals under-annuitize in the private market. That is, if you took away Social Security, the typical elderly person, when they retire, will not buy an annuity. They will not take their retirement money and convert it to an insured annuity. Instead, they seem to take their chances themselves. And some economists believe that they shouldn't be taking their chances themselves. In fact, it's a good idea for the government, in some sense, to force people to take their retirement income as annuities, as insured annuities, rather than take it as a lump sum. But other economists sometimes wonder whether people are actually wise not to annuitize. That is, people may, somebody who retires at age 65 and has $300,000, maybe it makes sense for them not to buy an insured annuity. If they just make a guess as to how much they can spend, maybe that's the best approach. Maybe they can, if it turns out that they live longer, then they can end up maybe borrowing more from their children who will be 10 years further along in their lives at that age. I mean, but if you retire at 65, you might have children who are in their 30s, and 10 years from now they'll be in their 40s, and if you by that point use up a lot of money, you may be able to depend on them. Or alternatively, you may get lucky with your investments. So if your investments earn more than you expected, or for example, if your house is worth more than you'd expected, then you can then even if you live longer than you'd expected, you still have enough money to maintain your lifestyle. So it could be that people don't, taking into account these factors, people don't feel that they need to annuitize their income. They can deal with the possibility of living extra long. They can deal with that themselves. And they may face other risks that are more important. That is, suppose you took your $300,000 and converted it to an annuity, but 3 years later, your children were in, you had a big financial need. Let's say they needed a down payment on a house. Then you would regret having annuitized. Or let's say 3 years from now you faced a really major medical situation that you had to pay for. Again, you would be sorry that you had annuitized your income. So there are lots of unexpected events in life other than living longer than you'd expected. And because there are these other uncertainties in life, it may make more sense to keep your money as a lump sum than as an annuity. And in fact, if that's true, then by forcing people to take their retirement income as annuities rather than as a lump sum, Social Security, instead of making people better off, might be making people worse off. So that's an issue with this, and why is Social Security an annuity? And that's it really depends on whether you believe you're making people better off by forcing them to take their retirement money as an annuity rather than as a lump sum. Okay, the next issue we have is why worry about Social Security? What we mentioned last time was that the big problem, a big problem with it is that the ratio of workers to retirees is falling. And we saw that the way Social Security is structured, current workers pay for the benefits of current retirees. So if the ratio of workers to retirees falls, the tax burden on current workers rises. And these tax effects may be big, in the sense that as taxes go up, people have less incentive to be in the labor market because of a tax on labor. The Nobel Prize winner in economics last year is a man named Edward Prescott, and one of his the points that he's made is that taxes affect the decision between market time and non-market time. Traditionally, in economics, we write down the labor leisure choice, that we say you're either going to work or you're going to sit on the sofa and watch TV, and those are the choices. Prescott makes the point that there's a kind of a third alternative in between working for a wage and sitting on the sofa, and that's doing work around the house. So that could be anything from childcare to painting the house to mowing the lawn and so on. And so that's included in this non-market time. So non-market time includes not just leisure, but includes sort of household maintenance work. And his point is that as you tax labor, because that's what the Social Security tax does, it takes a fraction of your wages and taxes it, so it reduces your take-home pay. So if you tax labor and reduce take-home pay, you create an incentive for people to do their work in do n this non-market work because it ends up saving taxes. That is, my classic example of comparative advantage is a surgeon who could mow her own lawn, but who doesn't do that because, or who could paint her own house, mow her own lawn, whatever. She doesn't do that because that's not her comparative advantage. She can earn more as a surgeon. Well, that may work for a surgeon, but somebody who's maybe making a little bit less, let's say a high school teacher, high school teacher, if they're being taxed on their labor income, they might decide that that even though they might have a comparative advantage in teaching, and someone else might have a comparative advantage in mowing their lawn, the teacher, after all the taxes are taken into account, the teacher says, I could actually mow my own lawn more cheaply, because if the lawn mowing service mows the lawn, that creates a market transaction and a taxable event. If the teacher mows his own lawn, that does not create a market transaction, does not create a taxable event. So you have, so in general, when you have these high tax rates, you have a lot of people doing work at home. Like I'm told, for example, that in Germany, where there's very high labor taxes, if someone buys something from IKEA, they're much more likely to assemble it themselves than someone in the United States. Someone in the United States is more likely to be willing to pay somebody to come and assemble the shelves or assemble the stuff than they are in Europe. In Europe, they're much more likely to do the work themselves. So this kind of do-it-yourself housework is what increases as you raise taxes. And because of that, when you raise taxes, you get a lot less market time, and you get a lot less source of tax revenue, and you have to raise the tax rates even more. And you can get into a situation where it's like a cat chasing its tail. You can't raise the taxes high enough to raise the revenue you need, because as you keep raising taxes, market time keeps dropping, and so there's less taxable income getting generated. So overall, the concern with Social Security is that as the ratio of workers to retirees is going to be falling, we're going to have to raise tax rates, and as you raise tax rates, you start to squeeze people out of market time, and as you squeeze them out of market time, end up with a smaller tax base, and so then you have to raise taxes even more, and so on. Okay, the next topic is privatization. What would privatization of Social Security do, and what would it not do? One of the claims that was made for in favor of privatizing Social Security, that is, in favor of having people take some of their money that would otherwise go into Social Security and go into private accounts, like what are now called 401k accounts, where people take some of their salary, and they put it into mutual funds. They invest that money. The idea is to make Social Security look a little bit like a 401k plan, where so instead of paying this tax in, and then in exchange for that, many years down the road, getting some Social Security payments from the government, you would actually have your own savings account that would go into certain mutual funds. That was the idea of privatization. One of the arguments that was made in favor of privatization was based on this notion that stocks are going to earn 7% after inflation, and that's a much higher return than Social Security. Economists are very suspicious of that argument because if you go with the view that stocks earn 7%, while the economy is only growing at 2 or 3%, then you're basically making up you're kind of out of thin air creating a huge gain that can sort of make people automatically richer. And we just don't believe that there's this sort of free lunch out there, that there's this big gain to be sopped up by putting people into stocks. And I've used this example to illustrate that. This is kind of, using some algebra. Let Y equal the total GDP, that's the total value of goods and services in the economy, and let E be the earnings of all the stocks. Then, in terms of simple algebra, the price of stocks relative to GDP, the ratio of the value of the stock market to GDP, P over Y, is equal to the price earnings ratio, PE, times E over Y, the ratio of earnings on stocks to GDP. So in recent years, just to give you an idea, the price earnings ratio has been around 25, and the ratio of earnings on stocks to GDP has been 10%. So all of GDP, the value of all goods and services, some gets handed out as income. A lot of it goes to workers, and some of it goes to profits on stocks, and that's the 10% that's there. So it obviously can't get past 100%, and it's probably not going to get much past 10 or 15%. Okay, so if GDP grows at 2% per year for 50 years, then the problem is that the value of the stock market is not going to grow by 7% for 50 years, which is the assumption that the stock market optimists made in trying to do their in trying to claim that privatization is going to be a completely safe Social Security. But if you assume somehow that P rose by 7% 50 years, it would mean that the ratio of the stock market wealth to GDP would be 10 times higher than it is today. So if you had a constant price earnings ratio, that would mean that the earnings to GDP ratio would have to be more than 100%. All of our GDP would go to corporate profits. So that makes no sense. Or alternatively, if you believe that the earnings to GDP ratio ought to be stable around 10%, then you'd need a price earnings ratio of 250. And once the price earnings ratio is more than 250, what that means is that people have paid a tremendous amount for stocks. You've got a stock that's earning $1, just $1 a year, and people are willing to pay $250 for it. And if you think of that in terms of rent buy calculations, it's almost you're almost sure not to be profitable. So what that would scenario would suggest is that people have way overpaid for stocks. So anyway, the conclusion is that a combination of 7% earnings on stocks, with the economy growing 2%, is completely unrealistic. And unfortunately, that combination has been exactly the combination that some people have used to sell the idea of privatizing Social Security. And when they sell it that way, they can make all sorts of absurd claims. For example, they can claim that regardless of the fact that the ratio of workers to retirees is falling, that you won't need to raise taxes at all, because you get this sort of miraculous gain in wealth that makes up for that. So that was a misleading story. And one of the things that happened in early 2005 is that somebody, and presumably economists, talked President Bush out of giving that misleading story and instead talked him into taking the view that even with privatization, other things would have to be done to take care of the fact that the ratio of workers to retirees was falling. And there was an article just in the Wall Street Journal, I think on October 20th or thereabouts, where it pointed out that there was this internal battle between the people who wanted to argue about in say under the assumption of the stock market scenario of 7% stock market. They were dubbed by their opponents the Free Lunch Caucus, and the people who wanted to take a more realistic view of the outlook for stocks relative to GDP, and those were called dubbed the Pain Caucus. So anyway, that was a story in the about where the conflict was resolved in favor of a more realistic outlook. So the next question is, will privatization cause a funding gap? So that was another issue that was brought up about privatization. This time, the controversy comes from the opponents. A point to make here is that if suppose Social Security were a pension, that is, the people were putting in money. There's, your Social Security taxes were being accumulated in order to pay your benefits. Okay, that's not the way it works now. Your Social Security taxes pay your parents' or grandparents' benefits, and then your benefits will be paid by your children or grandchildren. But if it were a pension in which your taxes were being used to pay your benefits, then it could be privatized at the stroke of a pen. That is, all we'd do is take the money that's in your account and give it to you. It would be simple. But because it's not a pension, because it's there's this funding, you're funding your grandparents, and your the funding for your benefits will be from your grandchildren. If you privatize, if you said, okay, now the money that you pay into Social Security, you don't have to pay in anymore. Now that's going to be your money for your retirement. Then who's going to pay for your parents and grandparents? So there would be less tax revenue from current workers to pay for current retirees. Okay, if there's less tax revenue, and the government's still going to pay the current retirees, then the government has to borrow more. And that's the funding gap. Now, offsetting that is that future government liabilities are reduced. That is, if let's say the government, instead of taking part of my paycheck and using that to pay for Social Security, takes that part of the paycheck and says, "Okay, Arnold, now you take that money and you invest it, and you invest it for your own retirement." Well, that means somewhere down the road, when I retire, the government is not going to have to pay out as much as it would if it were promising me Social Security. So the net effect of that should be zero. That is, the a future liability is being erased just as a current liability is being created. The current liability is that the government has to go out and borrow money to pay for current Social Security retirees. The liability that's erased is the future need to raise taxes to pay for my Social Security benefits in the future. I think that the argument about the funding gap is wrong, but it's one that gets used a lot. Because people see all of this increased need to borrow in the short term, that's the thing that they focus on. They don't focus on the reduced need to borrow in the long term. But the economic effect really ought to be about zero, even if the government did borrow more in the short term. The next question is, well, what exactly would privatization do if you're just swapping liabilities back and forth? One thing it would do is it would keep Congress from being able to disconnect benefits and taxes. Because what happens now is when Congress raises benefits for Social Security, which they haven't done for several years, but they used to do quite regularly, when they raise benefits for Social Security, they don't necessarily have to raise taxes at the same time, because the benefits are going to be paid for out of future taxes. So what Congress is essentially doing is committing future tax revenue to Social Security when they raise benefits today. And there's a big political incentive to do that, because you help your reelection chances today, and you sort of push the problem of paying for it down the road, which people have done to the point where we're almost at the down the road point where we're going to have to worry about how we're going to pay for all the benefits in the past that Congress has put together. The other thing that privatization would do is it would give people incentive to earn more and save more. Under Social Security now, if you work more and earn more, That doesn't ne necessarily increase your retirement income by very much, because your money kind of gets thrown into this tax pot and then comes out of this benefits pot. If instead you were keeping the money and investing it yourself, then you're then less of it is taxed, and you have more of an incentive to stay in the labor market, to put in more market time, and to save more for retirement, because you're not getting your retirement paid for out of tax revenues. So there would be some more connection between private behavior and private results, and that would give people incentive to earn more and save more. So that might be a positive economic benefit of privatization. But what privatization would not do is change the ratio of workers to retirees, which is the real kind of killer in terms of retirement and especially Social Security going forward. The fact that the ratio of workers to retirees is going to keep falling and falling, first as the baby boomers retire, and then as the impact of progressively smaller families kicks in. The ratio of workers to retirees is going to fall, and so anything that's structured like Social Security that depends on the ratio of workers to retirees is going to be in trouble. And it will be in trouble even if it's privatized. So the things that can be done to handle that are things like adjusting the retirement age for longevity. As you probably know, back when Social Security was enacted, someone who retired at age 65 wasn't expected to live much longer than 70. Now that person would be expected to live well into their 80s, and that will probably increase a lot going forward. So we have a much longer retirement period now than when Social Security was first enacted. And when you have a longer retirement period, that raises the ratio of retirees to workers, or conversely, it lowers the ratio of workers to retirees. Each worker has to support more retirees because the retirees are living longer. So a natural thing to do would be to adjust the official retirement age for longevity. That doesn't mean you force people to work until age 70, but you say that you have to postpone collecting benefits until, let's say, 70 or 72 or 73. And if the official Social Security retirement age were gradually raised to something like 72 over the next 15, 20 years, that would completely solve Social Security's funding problems. There would be nothing else you would need to do to eliminate the gap between what Social Security is going to be taking in and what it's promised to pay out. So just a very slow, gradual increase in the retirement age would solve the problem. But that's something, for whatever reason, certain political groups have said is absolutely unacceptable. I mean, it's a little strange in that the political groups that group that says it's most unacceptable is the AARP, which supposedly speaks for people who are now, in their, at age 50 and higher, and yet the increase in retirement age that we're talking about is for people mostly age 50 and lower. So the AARP is claiming to speak for people that are definitely not members of the AARP. So it's a very it's frustrating to me that gradually raising the retirement age for people age 50 and younger is being taken off the table as an option by the AARP, which is people who are 50 and older who right now would not be affected by that. Anyway, as I said, I find that one frustrating. Another solution, and this is the one that the Bush administration wound up proposing, is to index benefits to prices and not wages. Prices don't go up as fast as wages because of productivity gains. As your productivity goes up, people's real income grows up, their wages outpace inflation. And so if you indexed Social Security benefits to prices and not wages, you would gradually slow the rate of growth of Social Security benefits. So arithmetically, this works. There's a question of whether it's, the fair or the right thing to do. It's sort of an it's, I think it was Joseph Stiglitz, another who pointed out that if it happens to be that real wages do poorly, that is, or productivity grows slowly, then indexing to prices and not wages won't do much to help Social Security, and conversely. So that what that means is that this fix might fail in exactly the situation where you most need it to succeed. That is, you most need it to succeed when productivity growth is low, but it might fail under those circumstances. And then a final solution, or final point to make about this solution, is that we need more saving. That is, we need to encourage people to save more. We have one of the lowest savings rates in the industrialized world. And when you're talking about people who are going to have very long lifespans after retirement, they need to be saving a lot more. And so we need to do have policies that encourage or perhaps even force people to save a higher proportion of their income so that they'll be less dependent on government after they retire. So to recap the main points of this lecture, first of all, Social Security is an annuity, an insured annuity, which is a good idea if you believe that the main concern people have when they retire is they don't know how long they're going to live, so they don't know how to spread the consumption based on their assets. However, there's a lot of reason to believe that there are other uncertainties that the elderly face that are more important than how long they're going to live. They face uncertainty about how well their children are doing and uncertainty about their health. And the issue of why worry about Social Security, the main problem with it is that it's structured to depend on the ratio of workers to retirees, and the ratio of workers to retirees is falling. Privatizing Social Security would not do anything to affect the ratio of workers to retirees. And so, to a first approximation, privatization would not make the fundamental funding problems of Social Security any better or any worse. The final point is that if you want to handle the problem of the ratio of workers to retirees falling, you have to address that more directly. Probably the most logical thing to do is to adjust the age at which you can receive benefits, that is the official retirement age, for longevity. So as longevity goes up, you raise the retirement age so that we stop this phenomenon of longer and longer retirements, which obviously is going to raise the ratio of dependency on government. So adjusting retirement age for longevity is the most logical solution to taking care of the problem that the ratio of workers to retirees keeps falling. And then the final point is that one way or the other, we do need more saving. People need to save more for their own retirements and not be as dependent on government for their retirement money.